everyone. Welcome to episode 3, the podcast Quantitative Investigations. My name is Steve Cohen, speaking from the great city of Colorado Springs, Colorado. And I'm here with Goose the Engineer. Say hello, Goose.
Yo.
What's for lunch there today, Goose?
Good old-fashioned Chick-fil-A.
Just so everyone knows, we are not sponsored by Chick-fil-A, but apparently they own half of the city of Colorado Springs because their lines always go 2 miles long.
And we totally, totally could be sponsored by Chick-fil-A in the future. So, Chick-fil-A, if you're hearing this, please.
Yes, if you're one of the 20 people listening. All right. So it appears that the format of this podcast is being set where at the beginning of each episode, I kind of recap certain new information from previous episodes. And before I start with today's episode, which is the federal budget and inflation, I want to go back to episode 2. So episode 2, I made the statement that according to the U.S. federal government, global and the International Energy Agency, global carbon dioxide emissions were flat, if not decreasing, since 2017 or 2018, and that it had no effect on the trajectory of the carbon dioxide curve. Now, that doesn't seem possible if carbon dioxide plays such a major role in carbon dioxide emissions, if they play such a big role in carbon dioxide concentrations. It seems to me, if carbon emissions globally went flat or decreasing, it should have affected concentrations in the atmosphere. Well, it didn't, and I conjectured. Ladies and gentlemen, that is my conjecture alarm. I conjectured that there was another source of carbon dioxide, which was the oceans. Well, a week later, without any fail, NASA comes out with a report. Aren't you just thrilled, Goose?
I couldn't be more excited if I tried, and I'm really trying.
Just so everyone knows, Goose is not an official part of the program, but he just keeps the podcast from being too boring. So the NASA writes an article saying that the Hunga Tonga volcano that erupted in January 15th of 2022 spewed 146 teragrams, which is 146 trillion grams of water vapor. And they made the comment that this could affect the climate. Well, of course, other gases come out in volcanoes. One of those gases is carbon dioxide. But you should all be relieved because I checked the climate data. And in January, the global temperatures decreased. And then, of course, they increased a little bit during the year, but they're still well below where they were in December of 2015. So have no fear. The Hunga Tonga volcano did not affect our climate. And if you listen to episode 1, you will understand why. The other major, major point that scientists seem to intentionally overlook is cold periods in our climate versus warm periods. We have what's called the conservation of mass, right? The conservation of mass. Mass is neither created nor destroyed, but it is transformed from one form to another. So there's only a certain amount of water vapor in the atmosphere, only a certain amount of water in the world. Well, in colder times, in colder periods like glaciations, a lot of that water is entrained in ice. Well, if that water is entrained in ice, there's less water available for humidity in the atmosphere. Therefore, there's less water available for precipitation. Therefore, the Earth is a colder, more inhospitable place. And we know this from the archaeological record. For example, there was a Clovis first settlement along the Chesapeake Bay. Well, they disappeared around 13,000 years ago. And according to archaeologists, they disappeared because according to the geologic record, trying to find various pollens and other types of plants in geologic layers, they discovered that there was a cold snap that really disrupted the climate and forced them to move. A colder planet is a more inhospitable planet. A warmer planet is more hospitable. Otherwise, during the medieval warming period, the Vikings never would have made it to North America. But yet they did, because it was warmer. The next thing, this just came up, and it's really interesting. Hey, Goose, do you believe in the Big Bang Theory?
Sure do, Steve, sure do.
Well, apparently that's in the process of being torpedoed. A little-known telescope called the James Webb Space Telescope took some images. And according to an article in Principia Scientific, these images show distant old galaxies that are small and still regularly shaped. They're smooth. Apparently, this means that if the universe was expanding, then these old distant galaxies would not be small, they'd be large, spread out. So apparently scientists are having a conniption because the Big Bang Theory may not actually be a theory and may actually be incorrect. This is amazing, but it also speaks to a very negative side of science. Scientists, just like everybody else, scientists are subjected to groupthink or gang mentality. So what happens is there's a theory and it becomes the thing of the day. It seems to be proven, but yet the Big Bang Theory was actually never proven. And actually, if you believe in the scientific method, it was never a theory. It was still, maybe it was a theory. Maybe it was proven. I don't know. But it was, from what I've seen, it's never been proven. And everyone jumped on the bandwagon trying to make money off of researching the Big Bang Theory, and now all of a sudden, it may not have actually happened. So, ladies and gentlemen, all I can say is that when you consider science, science is not static, and you can't necessarily take as the gospel scientific theories. I'll give you another example, Newton's laws of motion. They were in existence for about 250 years until a certain gentleman named Albert Einstein proved that Newton was incorrect when particles approached the speed of light. I wish I could move at the speed of light. Doesn't everybody, Goose?
It'd be better than sitting in rush hour traffic, that's for sure.
Okay. So that was our episodic update for the day. Now we're going to get on to probably what is going to be the most boring podcast in the podcast universe. I mean, I literally may actually fall asleep doing this podcast. Goose may actually have to walk in and, like, poke me with a hot stick to keep me awake. That's how boring this is going to be.
Let's go.
What we're going to be talking about is the federal budget and inflation. The two have been tied together on recent events because of government overspending, and there's a lot of rhetoric on how government overspending creates inflation. But first, it's really important to understand how to actually view the federal budget. So, getting to the basics, the U.S. federal government works on a fiscal year. That fiscal year goes from October 1st to September 30th. And the year is based on the September 30th year. So right now, this is August of 2022. So we're in fiscal year 2022. Fiscal year 2023 starts October 1st of 2022. The way the government produces a budget is once the new fiscal year starts and around November, federal agencies start producing a budget request. And then the president's office starts compiling that and then produces what is called the federal budget. And then that gets sent up to the House of Representatives to be voted on. And then the Senate votes on it. But according to the Constitution, Article 1 of the Constitution, the House of Representatives must produce all spending bills. And then the Senate goes ahead and votes, reviews, and then they have all kinds of reconciliation. But all spending bills must start with the House of Representatives. And it takes 2 years to close the books on a fiscal year. So fiscal 2022 will end September 30th. It won't be until 2024 when the books on this fiscal year are closed. Here's the interesting thing. I used to argue with people about the federal budget, and everyone said, well, Bill Clinton balanced the budget in 1999. I made the point he had no idea he balanced the budget until he was out of office, because it takes 2 years to close the books. But yet he actually did. There was a budget surplus in the last 1 to 2 years of Bill Clinton's presidency, although the amount of debt still increased under Bill Clinton's presidency. And this brings us to another point: the difference between deficit and debt. When someone says there's a budget deficit, that means a budget deficit is the shortfall for any given year. So, for example, if by the end of fiscal 2022 we have a shortfall of $1 trillion, that budget deficit is $1 trillion. The national debt is the sum of all the individual budget deficits. Very important to understand. So when Congress or the president says, oh, we're going to reduce the deficit by 50%, and then they expect a pat on the back, don't give them one. Because the equivalent to what they're saying is this. Let's say you earn $40,000 a year, right? Let's say you earn $40,000 a year. Let's say your debt is $320,000 a year. And let's say this year you only increased your debt by $1,000 instead of $2,000 like the previous year, and you're going to congratulate yourself. No, you're not going to congratulate yourself, because you're still increasing your debt. Unlike in the 1980s, where for some reason it was popular to say that there was good debt and bad debt, it was a complete lie. There is no such thing as good debt. There's necessary debt. If you want to buy a house, I have a house, I have a mortgage, that is debt. It's not good debt, it's necessary debt. But there's no such thing as good debt, even with government. Debt should be eliminated. Sometimes debt is necessary, but needs to be minimized. So, now that we got the basics down, any questions, Goose? Did I lose you already?
I have coffee, so I'm good, but...
I'm glad you have coffee. All right. So, let me ask you a question. Goose, do you know where to find... Do you know how to look at the budget, the federal budget? Would you even know where to go?
Page one, the table of contents.
No. Okay. So, excuse me. What you can do is you can search on federal budget, fiscal year, whatever year you're looking in. You pull up the budget. What you want to do is go to the budget summary tables. You don't need to read anything else, because probably everything else is a bunch of mumbo jumbo. Right? You go to the budget summary tables. What do you find? So right now I'm looking at the budget summary tables for the federal budget fiscal year of 2022. And what they do, they give you the previous 2 years. Remember, the books don't close on a fiscal year until 2 years later. So the budget summary tables, table S1, which is the budget totals and it's a summary, starts in 2020, fiscal year 2020. So what you find is you see our receipts, our outlays and what the deficit is. Immediately, you see from 2020 to 2031, we always have a deficit. So what you know right off the back, right off the top, is that the federal government is not really trying to balance the budget. They don't care. They don't care. No respect. And to me, how you spend someone else's money is a sign of respect. There's no attempt. Our deficit in 2020 was $3.1 trillion. Our projected deficit in 2022 was $1.8 trillion. In 2031, our projected deficit is $1.6 trillion. They're not even trying, okay? The next thing is you go down this table, you see what our gross domestic product is. And the gross domestic product is the total sum of goods and services that are purchased in the United States. And in 2020, the GDP was $21 trillion. In 2022, the projected GDP is going to be $23.5 trillion. And then they keep projecting as time goes on. By the way, you can take all those projections beyond the current fiscal year and throw them out the window. They're worthless. And I'll tell you why. But I'll tell you why later. So what you can also see, what's also important is on the same table, this is table S1, you see receipts as a percentage of GDP. Very important. Receipts is revenue. Now, I did an analysis, and I'll have to credit Glenn Beck, a person who I can't stand more than life itself. I'm just kidding. I'm just trying to throw names so I get someone, you know, get 20, 30 people to listen to the podcast. I think it was like 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, Glenn Beck was on Fox News. He made the statement that when you look at the overall average of revenue as a percentage of GDP, it is, he said, I thought it was about 17.9% with a standard deviation of 1.4%. Everything okay, Goose?
Oh, absolutely.
Just throwing out these numbers.
JJ went to go get food, so we'll see what he gets when he gets back.
Our new sponsor, right? Okay, so that's what Glenn Beck said. And I was like, that just doesn't sound right. So what did I do 10, 15 years ago? I found the data, and I confirmed what he said. Which, by the way, this is what I've been known to do ever since figuring out that climate change was not anthropogenic. So what I did here was to also, I went back and I looked at, I found some historical tables and I looked back and calculated what our revenue from, it was 1935, and if I'll have to just try and muddle through my tables to see if I can actually find those tables. And I probably can't right now. There it is. There we go. Okay. So what did I do? So from 1930 to 2021, I found the data that lists revenue and GDP and as a percentage. And I found what was some historical tables, and I think those came from the IRS. So when I plotted up, I created a table, I plotted up all the columns, year, revenue, GDP, and calculated the percent. The first thing that's very interesting is that our GDP, our revenue as a percentage of GDP was always in the single digits from 1930 and on until 1943. 1943 was the first year that revenue hit double digits. With double digits as a percentage of GDP, which I found that to be pretty interesting. When I redid the calculation, though, the federal government, apparently, I messed up this calculation. Goose, what did you do to my calculations?
I messed it up. It's on me.
Nah, I'll fix it. This is called using Excel on the fly. That's what this is called. And so I'm going to go from 1942 when we hit double digits to 2021. And here we go. So that average is 17.61. So from 10 to 15 years ago, from 1942 to 2021, the average percent revenue with respect to GDP is still around 17, but a little bit more than 17%. And the standard deviation is probably going to be a whopping 1.4, but I have to redo that calculation because somebody messed up my spreadsheet, and that somebody is probably going to be me, but I can't be certain. Can't be certain. There we go. The standard deviation is 1.43%. So two standard deviations away from a mean is about the 95th percentile in confidence. What does this mean? This means that the United States federal government has the ability to predict fairly accurately how much revenue it is going to have to spend for the next year. You just take a look at the previous fiscal year's GDP, you multiply it by 17.61%, and you have a good chance that you're going to be on budget. If you want to be conservative, you subtract 1.43% from that 17.61, and you'll have a more conservative budget. The United States federal government, Congress and the president, CBO, they all know how much we are going to have to spend, but they don't care. Now, what does this really mean? Well, when you look, and this is a trick of Congress, and it's a really kind of nefarious trick. When you're looking at this table S1 and you're looking at what the predicted receipts as a percentage of the GDP are, they're going to 2023, 18.9%, 2025, 19%, 2030, 19.8%. It's garbage. They're lying. It is a trick. It is a trick Congress plays because from 1942... or 1943, I guess, to 2021, the average is 17.6. They're lying. And this is one of the most nefarious tricks that Congress plays when they say, oh, yeah, we're going to balance the budget in 10 years. They're lying. They're lying. And this is one of the ways they do it, ladies and gentlemen. So moving on. The next table... Table S3 is how we spend our money. We have two types of spending. There's discretionary spending and mandatory spending. Discretionary spending is the spending that runs the federal government, right? It is the spending that runs the federal government. Mandatory spending is the spending that is actually for our social programs. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, other mandatory programs I'm reading from the list, and also servicing the national debt. Now, in 2022, the net interest on the national debt is $305 billion. So let's do a little brain damage arithmetic. In 2022, our budgeted discretionary spending is $1.667 trillion. Okay? So we'll take $1.667 trillion and we'll add to that the outlays, $5.7 trillion. All right, so we get a total of $7,374 billion that apparently that is our total, what we consider our total budget, right? But no, actually, I'm going to take that back. The spending, no, that is it. That's our total budget. That's the total spending that we're planning on for 2022. Out of that spending, if we just look at what goes to discretionary spending, that's the $1.66 trillion. We divide that by the, let me do a little brain damage arithmetic here. Arithmetic on the fly, my friends. That's how it works. Divided by 7374. 23% of our budget, 23% of our spending, I should say, is discretionary. 23% of our spending is going to run the federal government. I don't know, you know, what that means, but that means to me that 77% is going to mandatory programs. Again, your social programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, servicing the debt. Okay, that's a really important number. That's a really important number because when you have the mandatory spending, and the reason why it's called mandatory spending is it's mandated each year and you can't change it. And quite frankly, I think it increases with inflation. So when you have all this money that you're required to spend, it's very difficult then to cut the budget. And so that's a number that's very important. It's very important to remember, 23% is discretionary, runs the federal government. 77% is the mandatory, the social programs. Let's go to receipts or revenue. There are actually a number of places where we get revenue. Income, individual income taxes is $1.6 trillion. That is the largest piece. But there's also some other very large pieces. Social Security payroll taxes, $965 billion. Medicare payroll taxes, $292 billion. Corporation income taxes, $212 billion. But the largest revenue source is individual income taxes. Pay attention to that $1.6 trillion. As a matter of fact, we're going to go off on a tangent, okay? We're going to go off on a tangent. Hey, Goosh, you want to go off on a tangent?
I could not be more excited to go off on a tangent. Run it. Run it, Steve.
I can feel the sarcasm. I can feel it. Wait a second. Hold on. I just have to make sure everybody's awake here. You know, I have to make sure everyone's awake. Oh, man, I don't have access to my conjecture alert. Oh, man. Anyway. So we're going to go off on a little tangent. Remember, individual income taxes are responsible for $1.6 trillion. And, you know what? And I was looking at 2020. In 2022, it's $2 trillion. Our total receipts for 2022 is just shy of $4 trillion. Okay? Now, there's a lot of talk about the distribution of individual income taxes, which tax bracket pays the most, which tax bracket should be taxed, it should pay their fair share. And it always comes down to, it seems, to the 1%. And I'm really sure how the 1% actually became the thing. But everyone is interested in taxing the 1%. Now, there's a website called taxfoundation.org. And taxfoundation.org is really the only place where I can find data that shows which tax brackets paid the most income tax. And the latest year that I can find is 2019. So in 2019, the top 1% paid 38.8%. of the total income tax. The bottom 50% pay 3.1% of the income tax. Now, we're dealing with different fiscal years. but I don't care. It's my podcast and I can do whatever I want. So let's assume, I can't stand it when Goose laughs. Let's assume in 2022, the top 1% is going to pay 38.8% of the tax. Okay, so keep that number in mind. We have $2 trillion that was paid, that we expected to be paid by total income taxes in fiscal year. So you take that $2 trillion, multiply that by 38.8% or 0.388. So apparently, just in this example, the top 1% would have paid $776 billion. Now, when we're talking about trying to balance the budget, let's say we double the tax. Let's say we double the tax on the top 1%. Okay? Well, why don't we say that? Now, for 2022, our shortfall is $1.837 billion. That's what's expected. So if you double the tax on the rich, you're still only adding another $776 billion. You can't make up that shortfall. Now, remember, if you doubled everyone's tax, you know, individual income taxes accounted for $2 trillion in 2022. That's projected. If you double everyone's taxes, you're still barely going to have a budget surplus. That's how in the red we are. And that's why all this rhetoric about the rich paying their fair share is a bunch of garbage. It is a bunch of garbage. You're not going to tax your way out of a budget deficit. You're not going to. It's not possible. And as a matter of fact, when President Trump was running for president, he claimed that he can get us in the black as far as budget deficits by growing GDP. And it's not true. It was never going to happen. And historically, it never happened, except for maybe the last time a president left office with less debt than when he came in was Herbert Hoover, I believe. That is conjecture, but I believe I remember that correctly. So here, that's the conjecture alert. So there, I've conjectured. All righty. So these budget summary tables, this is the only thing worth looking at when it comes to the budget. And it's very important because you can see how the government spends. You can see the various programs. And you get a picture of basically the kind of budget trouble that we're in. And it's all in black and white. It's all there. Again, there's no such thing as good debt. There's no such thing as good debt. So the more debt that we accumulate, the worse we are. Debt is actually friction on an economy. So our debt right now is around $30 trillion. Let's say we didn't have that debt. That would mean we'd have right now another $300+ billion to spend on whatever we wanted or to put away for a rainy day. When you're paying for debt, that means you can't pay for anything else. It is friction on an economy, and that is not a good thing. I'm going to go through the budget summary tables just one more time just to see if there's anything else worth mentioning. Okay. So I urge everyone to go take a look at your budget summary tables. One of the other things I did when I was doing this analysis on revenue as a percent of GDP is I wanted to take a look at the effect of tax bracket on revenue. So I do what I always do. I tabulate the data and make a graph. And I went from 1930 to 2021 and made a graph. I made a graph of maximum tax rate versus GDP, maximum tax rate versus revenue. And what I found is that I found data that I just cannot make any sense out of. I cannot reasonably find any relationship between the tax bracket, between the tax rate for the top tax bracket and revenue. Now, why is that? Good question. I don't know. I do not know. However, there are a couple of options. Number one, maybe there's something that is corrupting the relationship between tax rate, the maximum tax rate, and revenue. Or maybe you have to account for the average tax rate. There's something missing. So here's what I tried to do, right? I tried to do this. Whenever you look at a tax bracket, there's always a tax bracket, there's always a dollar level at which that tax rate becomes effective. So when you look at the maximum tax bracket, you have the actual tax rate, but then you have the dollar value above which that tax rate becomes effective. So, for example, and I'll never be able to find this now that I'm looking for it. For example, you may have a tax rate, like right now you may have a tax rate of 37%, maximum tax rate of 37%, but it may not be effective until you reach an income of $300,000 to $400,000, that kind of thing. So what I thought, oh, here it is, ha ha, found it. So for example, In 1916, the top tax bracket was 15%, but it was only applicable to taxable income over $2 million. And when you go to the latest data for which I have, which in this table is 2018, the top tax bracket was 37% for taxable income over $600,000. So what I did was I tried to condition that tax rate by the taxable income to see if somehow I can bring some clarity to the relationship. And what I found was simply amazing. The data was still pretty bad. I still cannot come up with any discernible relationship. So there's something. Remember what I said in the first episode, the truth is like God. If you don't look for the truth, you won't find it. Even if you look for the truth, you may not find it. And someone's always standing in your way between you and the truth. In this case, I'm looking for the truth. I can't exactly find what I'm looking for. So every time I hear a pundit or some politician say, when you cut the taxes, revenues go up, I can't find that relationship. So I can neither confirm nor deny. So what I do in that case is I don't believe the person. That's kind of where we are. So we've gone over the federal budget. And again, I urge everyone to take a look at the budget summary tables. I want to talk a little bit about inflation. Well, I don't really want to talk about it, but it seems applicable to these days. Hey, Goose, you awake over there?
Oh, yeah. Back at it like a bad habit.
Nice. All right. You know, I shouldn't be dishing on Chick-fil-A since I'm drinking one of their diet sodas. Okay. Inflation. The term inflation is used as a pejorative. For example, it's used as a pejorative, like a blizzard. Oh, blizzards are bad. You get a blizzard in the mountains, people crash, there's avalanches, people get stuck, people lose power. But when it comes to the spring, that blizzard then turns into drinking water for millions of people. Inflation is a natural part of our economy. It is natural. Sometimes inflation is a sign of a healthy economy. And I'm sure people are basically saying, this guy is out of his mind. While that might be true, let me give you this example, okay? In the early 2000s, I don't remember exactly when, the Bakken shale in North Dakota, I think it might be in Montana too, came online. Bakken Shale, huge oil and gas reserves. People started flocking to North Dakota. Then the recession of 2008 hit. People are still flocking to North Dakota. And if you're willing to work 80 hours a week, you'll earn $80,000 to $90,000, maybe even $100,000 a year, working your butt off, but you're going to earn that money. And in a recession, when people needed money, that was a lifesaver for some people. The epicenter of the Bakken Shale huge boom was Williston, North Dakota. So what happened? You had all these people flocking to North Dakota to work the Bakken Shale. Well, now housing prices increased because you need housing. Now you had more demand for food, more demand for supplies. People, anyone who was willing and able left their jobs and went to the Bakken Shale to work. So Walmart was hiring management trainees at $19 an hour. That's inflation. But that kind of inflation is organic because it's driven by demand for people, and it's driven by demand for a commodity. So everyone was making more money, but things started costing more. But because people were making more money, they could afford it. Not everyone, of course. There are always some people who will get left behind in that kind of boom. But that kind of inflation is natural, is organic. So let's talk about supply and demand. The law of supply. And I got this from WallStreetMojo.com. Who knows if it's true or not? I was trying to find some quick descriptions of supply and demand just to help myself. So here's what I got. The law of supply. The law of supply states that the higher the price of the goods, the higher the quantity will be available. So the more supply. Therefore, producers are ready to supply more at a higher price. Bingo, right? The reason is that selling higher quantity at a higher price will increase their revenue. Now you got the law of demand. The law of demand states that if all other factors are equal, the higher the price of a product or good, the lesser the people will demand that product or good. So supply and demand work as counter forces. When you're looking at inflation and organic inflation, it's sometimes difficult to see what the cause is. Is it the supply or is it the demand? The gas prices, okay? Right now, gas prices, although they've come down a little bit, you know, I paid $3.90 a gallon last time I bought gas. A couple of weeks ago, I paid $4.50 a gallon, up from $2.20 a gallon before the Biden administration. Now, I know this is going to sound political, but this is just absolutely fact. And I covered this in episode 2. Coming out of the COVID crash, the supply of oil and gas did not reach the levels that it was before COVID. This was intentional. The Biden administration ran on cutting oil production. They stopped the Keystone Pipeline. They stopped oil leases. But remember, it's not an oil lease that allows someone to drill and produce oil. It's a permit. So just because the federal government may lease some land for oil development, if they don't issue permits, you're still not getting to be able to drill. This is what they said they were going to do. So we had the supply of oil below where it was pre-COVID, but yet because we're coming out of COVID, demand increased. That's a cause of inflation. That, now I'm not going to say that's organic inflation, but yet it is inflation. Now, there's another kind of inflation. The other kind of inflation is government-induced inflation. How does that happen? Goose, do you have any idea how that happens?
Not even a little bit.
Neither do I, so we can stop recording right now. I'm just kidding.
I almost hit the pause button and everything. I was like, we're done? Don't play these games. This podcast is going to end.
Excuse me. Okay. So, remember how I talked about the debt. Remember that the more debt you have, the more your annual interest payments are going to be. What does the government do to pay its debt? It prints money. Money, when you're talking about a Federal Reserve system, which those type, or a central bank system, which is basically most of the monetary systems around the world, money is subject to supply and demand. The value of a nation's currency is compared to other nations based on how many people want that currency. This is why we have currency traders. They make their money trading currency. The United States has a relatively strong currency. Why is that? Because we have a large economy, we pay our debts, and people consider American debt to be relatively safe. Okay, great. So, just like Beanie Babies, though, people will want Beanie Babies, but the more you start producing Beanie Babies, and if you're oversaturating the market for Beanie Babies, the value of the Beanie Baby is going to go down. If you're increasing your debt and you're increasing the net interest that you need to, and principal that you need to pay, you're printing money. The more money that you have to print to pay your debts, the less that dollar is worth. That is inflation. And if you think that this can't have a devastating effect, I should turn your attention to the Treaty of Versailles after World War I. The Treaty of Versailles required Germany to repay the Allies for the costs of World War I. So they had this, Germany had this enormous debt. Well, what happened? What did they do? They were printing money. What happened as the more money they were printing, the less the money was worth. So you're paying $40 for a loaf of bread, or you're paying like $60 for a 12-pack of Budweiser. So, and that particular situation, when you're devaluating your currency, that, of course, most people attribute that to World War II, and I would happen to agree. The more money you have to print to pay debt, the more your currency is devalued, and the more inflation occurs. And you get to a point, there are other countries around the world that have extraordinary inflation. This happened in Venezuela. It happened in Venezuela where they were running out of goods and people, there were bread lines, and people were wishing they can overthrow the Maduro government. It's the same thing. It's in hyperinflation. That's why debt, our national debt, is actually a national security issue. Think about it this way too. As I stated, 50%, the bottom 50% of the people in this country pay 3.1% of the income tax to the federal government. That means there are a lot of people who were not earning enough money to pay tax. A lot of those people are also going to be on public assistance. The more debt that we accumulate as a nation, the more at risk our monetary system is going to be. Who are the first people who are going to get hurt? Tell me, who are the first, Goose, who are the first people who are going to get hurt?
I'd have to imagine it would be the bottom 50%, Steve.
Yes. They're gonna get hurt. So when you're listening to your politicians and they're talking about the debt, you need to look at the budget summary tables. You need to understand what inflation is and how the federal government absolutely, number one, lies to us about repaying debt, how they actually misrepresent positive changes by claims of reducing the deficit. We're only going to get rid of our debt when we actually have budget surpluses. We need a lot of budget surpluses. Now, let's say we have $1 trillion of budget surpluses a year. Well, in 30 years, we can actually get rid of our debt. But we don't really even need to get rid of the debt completely. As long as the debt is a small percentage of our GDP, which you can get from where? That's right, the budget summary tables. Let's go to the budget summary tables and let me show you. So, I was wrong, I lied. You can see the GDP, but you can't see the total. Wait a second. I'm sorry. No, you can't see the total debt. So right now, our national debt is around $30 trillion. But you can see right now, in fiscal year 2022, their projected GDP is $23.5 trillion. That is upside down. You don't want your debt to be greater than your GDP. You just don't want that. Let's say our debt was 20% of our GDP. That would be a healthy debt to GDP ratio. But we need to get there. And only when you understand where we are with our federal budget and how that's going to affect the stability of our economy and in fact the potential for hyperinflation as time goes on, you can understand what our politicians need to do. But I guarantee you, our politicians don't care, because our politicians know all this. Our politicians know everything. They know how much debt we have, and they know the damage that it can do to our economy. It's up to you to become educated. So with that, I think I have come to the end of episode 3. Hey, Goose, how long did I talk today?
52 minutes and 53 minutes now.
All right, so what do I need, another 10 minutes to summary? I think I just summarized everything, so I think I'm gonna pass on the summary.
Yeah, I think you need to ignore your haters, and and you could just end the podcast with no summary.
I have to ignore my haters because there are just so many.
I know. All 23 of the people that listened to episode 1 are now haters.
Okay, well, thank you everyone for your attention today. Like I said, I'm sure this would be voted the most boring podcast on iHeartRadio, but I'm telling you, important stuff. Thank you very much. This is Stephen Cohen from Colorado Springs. On behalf of Goose the Engineer, I bid you a fond adieu.